It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Hello, greetings, salutations. Welcome to a very special Mets lose another series. Mets trade one of their free agent to bees. Trade deadline eve edition of Rico Bronya. How we doing? We will get into the Met Marlins series at some point. We will do our normal kind of routine. Name a Rico. I'm the man right now. Star of the series. Net negative. We'll read your emails. So we will at some point talk about this listless final two games of the four-game series against the Marlins and the 10-game homestand. They lose 3 out of 4 to Miami after winning game one. They finish this homestand 4-6, and away we go. But obviously the focus, not just over the last 48 hours, but certainly over the next 24 hours, is the MLB trade deadline. We discussed the AJ Minter trade in episode 731. And then this literally broke 5 minutes into the game on Sunday afternoon that the Mets were trading Freddy Peralta to the Tampa Bay Rays. So the timing of it was very strange. I was watching this game live. I sat down, had the scorebook ready. I was going over the roster moves that they had made because they had made a couple of roster moves in which they sent down Jonathan Pintaro. He got another one of those, thanks for pitching, now we're sending you out, like they did to Xavion Curry a day earlier. And they call up Robert Stock, and they called up another guy, which I admit, and it's odd because when you do a Rico Bronya and you talk about the Mets and all the Syracuse shuttle moves, you kind of know everybody. I had no idea who Bryce Connelly was, and they called him up. So I'm jotting down these roster moves, and I'm looking at the Met bullpen, and I'm saying, wow, they have a bunch of guys that in theory are just not available, led by Freddy Peralta, who the Mets decided to not start on Friday because they knew they were going to trade him. Yeah, that was the most obvious of the trade deadline moves, that they're going to trade Freddy Peralta. And so they start Kodai Senga, and now they decide to give a start to Robert Stock. More on him later. So I'm jotting this down as I sort of in the background here, Gary Cohen mentioned the Mets have traded Freddy Peralta. So I quickly go to the text chain. And during this moment, and really it was the moment plus 5 to 10 minutes more, the thoughts jump through your head, not where is Freddy Peralta going? We quickly saw it was the Tampa Bay Rays, but what'd they get back? And I said on the last Rico Bronya that what we need to do is lower expectations for the trade deadline. The trade deadline usually does not warrant huge returns. And remember, a few hours earlier, the LA Dodgers had acquired Tarek Skubal in a return that doesn't jump out at you. And we'll talk a little bit about Skubal a little bit later on this Rico Bronya, its impact on the Mets, but really the impact on baseball. So you see the Skubal deal. You know what they got for AJ Minter. You think back to past trade deadlines, and obviously Freddy Peralta's been terrible. And let's not leave that part out. He's pitched to a 4.99 ERA. I did not have huge expectations on the return. And I believe we do need to treat trade deadline acquisitions as a lottery ticket. So I see the names, like 99.8% of us. We have no idea who these people are. We quickly go to Baseball Reference. We quickly go to MLB Pipeline. And what jumps out at most is that they got back the 15th best prospect in the Tampa system in Aiden Smith, the 27th best prospect in the Rays system in Emelian Petre, and then the 26th best prospect in the system in Gary Gilhill. And I think when you hear those numbers on the back end of getting the 21st and 29th best prospects in the Twins organization, it feels like a very blah return. But we need to be fair about this. The guy had a 5 ERA. You saw what the return was for maybe the best pitcher in baseball. I mean, right now, who is the best pitcher in baseball, especially over having a track record like Skubal has? He's right up there. And while, yes, the Dodgers gave up 2 top 100 prospects, it didn't feel like a massive return. So you see this 15, 26, 27, and no, it doesn't jump out at any of us. But I think what we need to realize is that that's the going return for a starting pitcher who's having a terrible season. And it's the going return at the trade deadline. I think if anything, it makes you, and it made me for a second, think back to the last couple of years when the Mets were on the other end of this and they were the buyers. And it's like, damn, it's so worth going for it when you're giving up guys who, yeah, they could turn into something, but they're not huge prospects. I mean, you're basically hoping that one of these guys turns into a top 100 prospect. And honestly, and I've said this on a previous Rico, You're just hoping they become major leaguers. And right now, they're years away from us even knowing. So I dug into the players. I think the guy who's probably most appealing, at least as of right now in the return, is this Emilian Petre. He's 23 years old. He's a left-hand hitting middle infielder, and he's putting up pretty good numbers at AA, and he makes contact. He is a bat-on-ball kind of player. So you look at the position he plays, you look at the skill sets he has, kind of that A.J. Ewing type of player, I think you view him and you could kind of convince yourself, all right, that's a guy who could see major league time with this team in 2028, maybe even 2027, considering he's performing well at AA. 23 years old, middle infielder, apparently his defense is solid. So even though he's the 27th best prospect in the Rays organization, you do have to remind yourself that coming into the year, the Rays had the 10th best farm system. So not all 27s are created equal. You know, you take the 27th best prospect in the Tampa system, and now you move them to a Met farm system that's graduated so many players and have had some guys whose stock has gone back, that guy could be a top 10 prospect. It's not crazy. So he, of the three guys they got back, in terms of the immediacy of it, the idea that this guy can come up and help the team at some point in the next couple of years, he jumps out at you. Aiden Smith is at single A and has played at rookie ball in single A, has not put up big numbers, but apparently is a toolsy player, an athletic player. I mean, I think you view a guy like that and say if he could ever make the major leagues and just be a fourth outfielder, just be a cheaper version of Tyrone Taylor, who is still a member of the New York Mets for now, that's probably a victory. And then the other guy is Gary Gill-Hill, who has an awesome name. I mean, are we going to start calling him GGH? But he's a New Rochelle guy, so he's a local kid, 21 years old, throws a lot of strikes, has not put up great numbers at AA, but I guess has a chance to be a back-of-the-rotation arm. Truthfully, he's probably a Syracuse shuttle guy a few years from now. So there's no one in this deal at this moment that is going to excite you, that's going to make you jump on the ceiling. But they are, as we've talked about, three lottery tickets. And also, and this is probably maybe the most important, can the Mets over the next 2.5 months build up their value more than what they just were and use them in another trade? Because the Mets are going to try to win in some form in 2027. We don't know what kind of season it's going to be, if there's a season at all, but this is not a rebuilding team. So as we talked about with David Stearns and his track record of selling at the trade deadline, which is not a long history because he mostly hasn't had to sell at the trade deadline, we have seen a lot of examples where some of the pieces that come back end up being traded elsewhere. So Emilian Petre plays really well at AA. Who knows? Maybe he's a part of a bigger trade a little bit down the road. But I will tell you, and I've gone back and forth on the whole, what do you do with guys like Luke Weaver and Waskar Brazoban who are under contract for another year? These returns and how overall underwhelming they are is probably more of a reason to not trade Luke Weaver and Waskar Brazoban. And if you listen to the Rico, you've heard me go back and forth on this because I've mentioned, you know, relievers are, they're so hot and hot and cold. They're so up and down. We've seen it in our own history, how relievers from one year to another can be great to really, really bad. That's why when you have a guy who's consistently good, like Tyler Rogers, who the Mets let go in free agency or are unable to re-sign, those guys are really valuable because most relievers are not like that. They're very, very up and down. But if the best you're going to do for Luke Weaver is the 22nd best prospect in a team's farm system, it doesn't feel worth it. It really doesn't. Like, the way I view the three guys they got back for Freddie, and you just heard it, is Aiden Smith is years away, toolsy kid who's right now struggling in single A. It sounds like Emilian Petre has got the highest potential, but is what? Maybe a bat off the bench. I don't know if he's an everyday player. And the same thing about Gary Gill-Hill. Maybe he's a back of the rotation arm. Maybe he's a spot starter. Like, if they make the major leagues, not even become stars, they make the major leagues, you would say that's a decent return. But for Freddy Peralta, who you're not re-signing and who's a free agent at the end of the year, you take whatever you can get. You take whatever return you can get. And hopefully, not that a lot of us trust David Stearns, but hopefully with all the teams that were interested, he was right that this was the best return, or the guys who could turn into the most, whether it's in future trades or helping you down the road, of any other deal. Luke Weaver and Waskar Brazoban, again, they're relievers. And eyes wide open, they could suck next year. We saw what Luke Weaver did last year, and Waskar Brazoban, even in his time here, has been up and down. But if the best you're going to do for a guy who's under contract for next year, and in Brazoban's case, for multiple years, if the best you're going to do are 20th-ranked prospects who, if they make the major leagues at some point, is a victory, then it's probably not worth it. So if I'm David Stearns right now with the guys under contract, and that is Luke Weaver, that is Waskar Brazoban, it's even Francisco Alvarez, who I'm not in love with moving. If you're going to trade those guys, there needs to be a bar, because you don't have to trade those guys. Clay Holmes is a little bit different. I'll get to him in a second. But you don't have to trade those guys. Excuse me one second. I need to get a tissue, because I do not want to wipe my nose on my shirt, though I have such an urge to, because I'm battling a cold. I didn't even know you get colds in August. I thought it was only a winter thing, but what the heck do I know? So I saved the YouTube audience from having to watch me wipe, liquids on my shirt. Very professional that I am, so I used a tissue. There needs to be a bar, a solid prospect bar, before I trade guys who are under contract for next year. And how about Waskar Brazoban giving us the ropey dope by doing the goodbyes or the hugs? And it wasn't a hug to say goodbye. It was a hug to say, what's up? And then he comes in the game. So if you weren't sure about it, Brazoban comes into the eighth inning of Sunday's game just to remind you, I'm still on this team. And I'll make you this prediction. And I fully understand this prediction could be wrong very quickly, because these trade deadline Rico Brunias have a chance very quickly to be outdated. At least the trade discussions, the results are the results, because trades can happen at any moment. But I kind of lean towards them not trading Waskar Brazoban, more so than Weaver, because Weaver's got 1 year left on his deal. Brazoban has multiple years of team control. And if you're not getting a good return for him, why am I trading him? Like, it wouldn't make that much sense. So I think a lot of the guys that fans have been on the fence about, and I'm sure the front office has been on the fence about, I don't think they move. Now, Clay Holmes, here's why this is different. While there is an advantage to having a guy still be on your roster when they get to free agency, how much of an advantage is it really? At the end of the day, Clay Holmes is going to opt out. He's going to become a free agent, and there will be an open bidding on Clay Holmes' services. So keeping him here, because the return isn't good enough, I don't think adds enough in terms of the advantage in keeping him. If the Mets want to sign Clay Holmes at the end of the year, even after a trade, I'm not going to lie to you, it hurts a little bit when he goes somewhere else. He could fall in love with that place. I think any home field advantage that you think you have in free agency, which is very limited to begin with, because it's really about the money and the ears, I admit it goes away. And as Gary Cohen pointed out in the broadcast, and it's almost like he had audio tapped my household. I was watching the game with my dad at his house, and he even said, how often are guys traded and then re-signed with the team that traded them? And the answer is rarely. We bring up Aroldis Chapman, but it's not a common thing. So I get that. But if the return on Clay Holmes is going to be a lottery ticket, it makes it less appealing. But he is a free agent. And because he's a free agent, and if you really want him, you just pay him, I would still lean towards trading him for the best return I could get. But I'm preparing everybody. I don't think the return is going to be great. We saw the return on Luis Castillo with the White Sox. Even the return on Tarik Skubal is still very underwhelming. Clay Holmes hasn't started a game in months. So as well as he pitched, and he was great for the Mets, and I'm sure there's a lot of belief that Clay Holmes can continue to take that step as a starting pitcher, I'm very skeptical on what that return would be. Look, here's the bottom line about the trade deadline. And for the older Met fans, or even for the younger Met fans, we've experienced sell-offs. You know, this is not that uncommon. We had it in 2017-18. We had it in 2023. We certainly had it in the early 2000s. Like, the Mets selling off guys is not a new phenomenon. We're not the Yankees where they've sold off once and it's like the biggest thing ever. But this is a reminder that as much as humans, we want to turn things into positives, this sucks. I would much rather be in the spot we were last year where we're overanalyzing the prospects we traded away for good major leaguers. Because the trade deadline returns are not that great. They're just not. And the most depressing thing, and I've said this before, even though Freddie Peralta needed to be traded, it's like when the Jets get rid of a quarterback. It's over for Zach Wilson. Aren't you excited? It's over for Sam Darnold. Aren't you excited? No, it's depressing. Because when you draft Sam Darnold or you draft Zach Wilson or you draft Mark Sanchez, there's really high hopes. And it's sad the day you get rid of them because it's like, wow, that was a failure. So let's go to Freddie Peralta. When the Mets traded for Freddie Peralta, there was mostly excitement from this fan base. My negativity wasn't that Freddie Peralta was going to fail. It wasn't that the Mets were going to be 20 games under 500. In fairness, I just thought they gave up a lot for a rental. But it is sad now, no matter how positive or negative or skeptical you were about that trade, to think that they gave up two top 100 prospects. No guarantee those guys turn into anything. Jet Williams' value's taken a hit down in AAA, and Brandon Sproat's been up and down. But they traded at the time two top 100 prospects for what we knew was a rental. We all knew it. As much as you wanted to convince yourself, oh, this is the guy they're going to re-sign, they were never re-signing him. They were never extending him. And this was the Mike Hampton move of 2026. That's what it was. And that's exactly the way you should view it. They traded for a guy to hopefully put them over the top.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
And while it is not all Freddie Peralta's fault, the man made 22 starts. He pitched to a 4.99 ERA. And overall, his time here was disastrous. And he's a big part of why this team failed. He's not the main culprit, but he's certainly one of the culprits. He is one of the reasons why the New York Mets of 2026 is the worst team money could buy part two. He came here. He never went deep into games. Five and fly is almost a compliment with the amount of times he went shorter than five innings. He wasn't very good. He got worse as the season went on. They didn't win when he took them out. When you acquire somebody, whether he was a true ace or not, and I remember we debated that upon the trade, is he on that top level or is he not? The bottom line is, a guy with that resume and a guy that you give up that much for, the expectation is when he takes the mound, you win baseball games. And that didn't happen. It didn't happen at all. And he didn't go deep into games. And it was funny watching Robert Stock, of all people, a guy who's pitched in Korea, a guy who's pitched in the Mexican League, a guy who's pitched in independent ball. You watch Robert Stock put together a performance on a Sunday afternoon that on most days, Freddie Peralta couldn't dream of putting together. That's depressing. That is a reminder that no matter what Jet Williams or Brandon Sproat turn into, don't be confused just based on them. And I admit that was my concern when they traded him, was what those guys would be. The Peralta results were abysmal. They were all-time bad, and it does make me appreciate, and I didn't do it for 20-plus years, what Mike Hampton did when he came here, because that trade was similar, right? You're trading for top-level guys who are free agents at the end of the year, and whether you sign them or not, it's about what are you going to do for me in the year I acquired you, and I gave up a lot. Now, I think the Mets gave up more for Mike Hampton than they gave up for Freddie Peralta because they gave up guys off their major league roster. Octavio Dotel was in the major leagues and was contributing in 1999. Roger Cedeno set the team record for stolen bases in a season. So I admit the return on Hampton stung more even than the return on Peralta, because you were talking about two guys that impacted that team in 1999. Jet Williams had never been to the majors, and Brandon Sproat had made a handful of major league starts. But Peralta comes here, and let's face it, he was a disaster. Is he as big of a disaster as Jorge Polanco? That's an off-season Rico now, isn't it? But as we analyze the returns and what they got and what happens from here, let us not forget that Freddie Peralta was an unmitigated disaster. He didn't come here and say the wrong things. He never gave the wrong answer with the media. And for all intents and purposes, Freddie Peralta seems like a great dude. But the results were awful. And that's the part, more so than the three prospects they got back and analyzing what they're going to be, or even Brandon Sproat and Jet Williams. That's the part that really saddens me, Hoff. He sucked. He came here and he sucked.
He did. No, but the one thing that you said that kind of screws me up a little bit, because he did say one thing was like, hey, by the way, I have time to get it right. Remember that statement where it was like they asked him that, you know, he wasn't holding his end of the bargain. And he said, yeah. Oh, don't worry. I got time. I'll figure it out. Like that wasn't a good response, dude. You've had more than enough time to figure it out and it wasn't working.
Yeah, that's the misstep, quote-wise, you want to get on him for?
I do, yeah. he's got plenty of time to figure it out in Tampa. A jerk.
You know, it puts Met fans in such a tough spot, because most Met fans, and certainly Hoff is one of them, want the Yankees to lose, right? That's part of the DNA of being a Met fan, that when we suck, when we have bad years, we're going to actively root against the Yankees. And there's nothing to be ashamed about. It's what we do. Freddie Peralta is now joining the team slightly ahead of the New York Yankees. So if Freddie Peralta pitches well, are we going to get upset? Are we going to be pissed off that now he pitches well? Or are we going to say great because it sticks it to the New York Yankees?
No. He's screwing both New York teams. Like that is a fact. I said this already once and I'll say it again. I can guarantee he's going to go six innings every game, quality starts every game, and he's going to be great in the playoffs. It's just going to, and the Rays are going to fix him.
Well, here's the concern with that, and the real concern besides just our emotions as fans. If you're David Stearns and you're us as Met fans, we look at him and say, why are we so bad then at this? Because a year and a half ago, the waxing poetic about the pitching lab and Jeremy Hefner and fixing guys like 2024, where a lot of guys had really good years, how could it go so backwards? I almost would feel better if Freddie Peralta struggles in Tampa Bay, because then it wouldn't be the Mets broke him. It would be, hey, there was just something wrong with Freddie Peralta. It wasn't a Met issue. And that's not to make anyone look better. It's that for the Mets to have success in the future, they can't have guys come here and get worse, because we're all going to be screaming and yelling about trading for this guy or signing that guy. And you can't have the thought that, well, the guy will just come here and suck. That can't happen. But there's been a lot of that recently.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's one of those things, too, where David Peterson looks better in a Cubs uniform. I mean, it just kind of is how it is. Maybe there's something when you leave here that it's a different, you feel the fresh start of it. And by the way, I did speak to Howard Johnson this week or whatever. He was in town for the 40th anniversary. We had a nice 50-minute conversation. So if you want to go check that out on YouTube or Odyssey app, whatever. I asked him about the 92 team, the worst team money could buy, and compare it to this team. First thing he said was, there's just too much turnover. It was too much. Yeah. You guys got to have chemistry, have to gel, and this team doesn't have it.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. That's been a big talking point about what went wrong with this 2026 team. Anyhow, I want to get into Scooble real quick, and then we will get into game 3 and 4 of this series against Miami. We'll read some of your emails, and obviously we'll pick a Rico on the man right now, star of the series, and a net negative. So I woke up in the middle of the night, Saturday into Sunday, and I saw the Tarik Skubal news that he was going to L.A. Not surprised. I don't think any of us are. I really thought the Milwaukee Brewers, though, would step up with the loaded nature of their farm system, almost honor the anniversary. Not the anniversary, because it's been, you know, how many years? I think 19 years since they made the trade for C.C. Sabathia, one of the great deadline deals of all time. That the Brewers, who have been so close and lost last year in the NLCS to L.A., that they would be the ones to emerge. But I'm not surprised. I don't think anyone's surprised that it was the L.A. Dodgers. The return on Skubal was very underwhelming. And so my first reaction was, why didn't the Brewers beat that offer? And I get it. Like, I'm not oblivious to the conspiracy theories. I have mentioned the conspiracy theories in the past that Rob Manfred probably likes when the L.A. Dodgers acquire superstars, because it helps their case for a salary cap. But this trade is not about salary cap. This trade is not about buying great players. Like, this trade is about the fact that the LA Dodgers have been able to build a good enough farm system despite their success on the field. And they put together a package, as surprising as it is to me, that I guess was better than every other package. Like, the conspiracy theory I can't get along with is that the Brewers stood down on an offer because they want to win fan reaction in the war over a salary cap, or that the Tigers accepted a lesser offer because of a PR stunt against the players for a salary cap. Like, that's the part of the conspiracy I'd have a tough time buying. But what I said when the Dodgers signed Kyle Tucker and they signed Edwin Diaz was that I think Rob Manfred, if you gave him truth serum, would say, this is great. This helps our cause. Because the players are always going to argue, well, we don't need a salary cap. Look at all the different champions. But if we continue to have the Dodgers overwhelm everybody by always getting the best players, fair or not, even if this isn't a salary cap related issue, we win the PR battle. So that I believe. And I know that Major League Baseball is trying a PR battle, because I've gotten plenty of comments about it. They run ads. They basically run campaign ads on MLB TV saying MLB needs a salary cap. So they are running like a campaign to win the hearts and minds of fans to convince them that a cap is needed. Well, one thing I know about politics, if we get in the weeds on, well, this is unrelated to the salary cap, it doesn't matter, because in politics, just like in this, it's perception. So I could sit here for 25 minutes and explain where the Dodgers do nothing wrong and how this has nothing to do with salary caps and salaries, but it doesn't matter, because there's a lot of people, baseball fans, who say this sucks. This is not good for the sport that the best team in the world that's won back-to-back champions traded for the best pitcher in baseball. And so whether it's cap-related or not, they are going to be angry and hence be the people that Rob Manfred and the owners have convinced, hey, we need a salary cap. But I don't think for a second that this trade has anything to do with that. It has to do with the fact that, to the Dodgers' credit, and as much as I hate them, I got to be honest and give credit where credit is due, they built a good enough farm system where this offer, this package, was enough to convince the Detroit Tigers, this is the trade we're going to make. And where I can't go with the conspiracy theories are that the Tigers took a lesser offer, or that the Brewers decided we're standing down when they have a legitimate chance to win a world championship because we want to win the publicity battle against the players on a salary cap. Give the Dodgers a lot of credit, man. I mean, they are everything we wanted to be. Let's keep that in mind. When Steve Cohen bought the Mets, our fantasy was that we were buying all the best players and we would have such a good farm system that we'd be able to buy the best players at the trade deadline. And let me remind you of something. This is not new. Let me take you all the way back to 2021. You guys remember the 2021 baseball season? Well, in 2021, the Mets were in first place for a long period of time. And then they collapsed towards the end of the season. 2021 was, yes, the Javier Baez trade, if you remember that. But the other thing that happened in 2021 is that the Los Angeles Dodgers had an incredible season. They won 106 games, but didn't win the division that year. They actually had to play in the wild card game because the Giants had this just ridiculous, ridiculous season. So the Dodgers won 106 games. They won a wild card game, and then they beat the Giants in the division series and lost in the sixth game of the National League Championship Series to the Atlanta Braves. So they won 106 games, which is probably more than they're going to win this year and more than they've won the last couple of years as they become this big evil franchise. 106 games, didn't get to the World Series, lost to the Braves. Why do I bring that up? They traded for Max Scherzer and Trey Turner at the trade deadline, and it felt obscene. But they did it because they were able to offer enough in return, because they continue to build a good enough farm system. Some of it by trades. Like, the key guy in this trade to Detroit, they got from Chicago from Michael Busch. So that seemed like a pretty good trade for the Cubs, because Busch has turned into a hell of a player. But one of the kids they got back is the top prospect in this trade that they made for Tarik Skubal. So it isn't all just drafting and developing. Some of it are just keen, smart trades. The Dodgers are a very smart organization. Andrew Friedman is one of the best executives in the world. So what makes them so horrific from the other side is that they've got the combination of money, but they do have the combination of being very, very smart. And I'm jealous. I'll be the first to admit it. I'll raise my hand. I thought, naively so, we'd be them. That we would be the ones who just, it's never enough. Let's keep getting better. It's never enough. And that's the Los Angeles Dodgers. So, look, it probably is easier to react to because we are so irrelevant in the whole grand scheme of things. We are not competing with the Dodgers. We are not the Atlanta Braves or the Philadelphia Phillies or the Milwaukee Brewers. And if we were, we'd be very frustrated. We'd be very frustrated. But we're not. We're just a rebuilding team or a retooling team for one season. But it's just good for them. Good for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
The one thing that does frustrate me a little bit is that if the Mets ever did get to that point of being that juggernaut that can, you know, we have a farm system, we have the money, we could do it. Now baseball is basically trying to take that all away. Isn't that like, not, I don't want to say ironic, but isn't that like just the Mets? Like,
want to hear a crazy conspiracy theory? I don't believe, but I may as well throw it out there since we all have conspiracy theories.
Go for it.
All right. So the reason that this all happened was, again, because the publicity battle of MLB needs a salary cap. The Dodgers continue to get better. So the Mets have traded two players at the trade deadline. The two teams they made trades with to improve. Two teams that got better are the Minnesota Twins and the Tampa Bay Rays. Are the Mets saying, hey, if we could help these small market teams and they can win a championship, maybe that'll help us not have a salary cap?
Listen, if that's the case, if that's what it takes, let's go. Help out the Pirates. Help out the Reds. Help out all these low-level teams. Let's do it.
Yeah, by the way, I don't believe that conspiracy theory. I'm just saying, let's have fun with it. Let's go crazy. Anyhow, let's talk about these games. If you want to hear about game one and two of the series against Miami, go to episode 731. We discussed it, the first two games of this series against Miami. Let's get into game three and game four. But before we do, remember, when you head out to Citi Field, you can celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser. Light, bubbly, and easy to enjoy. Whether you're at Citi Field or your favorite spot, ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name, a new tradition. Served chilled, imported from Japan, the official sake of Rico Bronya. Enjoy responsibly. Zach Thornton finally gave us his first kind of start. He's been on a great run. A part of his run has been efficiency, has obviously not been giving up runs, but going deep into games. What was so unfortunate for Zach Thornton's outing is that it sort of got derailed by Francisco Lindor. And I hate to pick on Lindor. Obviously, his offense has picked up a lot. He had six hits in this series, more than anyone else. Went 6-for-12. We'll talk about him later in the Rico I'm the Man Right Now Star of the Series candidacies. But the error against Otto Lopez in the top of the first inning on Saturday, I think in a lot of ways, when you look at where Thornton's outing went a long ways into really putting him behind the eight ball. because it was a long at-bat to begin with. It's a play Lindor's got to make, and now the Marlins have a runner on and nobody out. Thornton has a long at-bat against Roberto Hernandez, which allows the Marlins to send Lopez on 3-2. And even though Hernandez hits a ground ball right to shortstop, should be an easy double play because the runner's going, he's now on second base with one out. And so what should have been two outs and nobody on turns into a runner on second, one out. And what happens, Liam Hicks hits a ball that because of where the base runner is, the Mets defense is shaded more to the right, and that ground ball turns into an easy RBI single. And great job by Thornton. It could have been worse because Hicks went the second on the throw home. He's able to get the last two outs, but he throws a lot of pitches. He gives up an unearned run, and that inning, and really his pitch count, which went in the wrong direction, got off to a bad start because of a defensive miscue by Francisco Lindor. The second inning was on him. Gives up the base hit to Kyle Stowers. And then, as we've seen so many times with this team, ahead of the count, a 1-2 pitch, Javier Sanoa hits for a 2-run home run. And so now the Mets are down 3-0. And that's not an excuse on anyone but Zach Thornton. Where I'll give him credit is that after he gives up the 2-run home run, he puts himself into more trouble, gives up a base hit, commits an error of his own on a throw he should not make on a swinging bunt by Esturi Ruiz, a David Stearns trade deadline acquisition in a sell-off many years ago. He gets through the back-to-back walks to Hernandez and Hicks by getting Xavier Edwards to line out. But his pitch count through two innings, 57 pitches. And you just know, especially with how he hasn't thrown that many pitches, even in his long outings, he's not long for the world. But I was surprised, and I'm not negatively surprised, I was happily surprised, that Andy Green, through four innings and 80 pitches in a game in which at this point they're down 4-2, allows him to start the fifth inning. I did not think that was going to happen, especially considering we've seen Thornton kept in that 80 to 85 pitch range, and that's over a longer period of time. Now you're talking about 40 pitches in 80 pitches in four innings. I figured there was no way that Andy Green would let him make that jump, but maybe it's the combination of needing innings, of saying to yourself, you know what? We just made all these roster moves. We've got bullpen arms that may be traded at any moment. Let's get as many innings as we can out of Zach Thornton. That's not a good reason to extend him. The reason you extend him is because he's a kid who you want to push, who you want to test. And Thornton came so close to getting through that fifth inning. Got the first two outs of the fifth, and then Kyle Stowers gave him a tough at-bat and drew a walk, and that was it. I don't disagree with Andy Green taking him out. At that point, his pitch count's 94. But hate to go back to picking on Freddie Peralta, but I'll do it anyway. Here is a rookie starter making his sixth major league start. The first two innings are a laborious grind. His fault, his defense's fault, and yet still came a pitch away from getting through five innings, something Freddie Peralta couldn't do, I think, five times this season. So it's a reminder of how bad Freddie Peralta was as a Met. I hate to say that. On the other side, the offense just, I mean, it was typical. Lacking the big hit. They're facing Tyler Phillips, the reliever converted starter. They had a chance in the first inning. Jared Young grounds out. Tyrone Taylor hits the 2-run home run. You would think it continues to enhance his trade value. And after that, after Taylor's home run, Tyler Phillips was mowing everybody down. In fact, the Mets, after the home run, couldn't even get a guy in runners in scoring position or a guy in runners in scoring position for the rest of the game. It was lackluster against Phillips, against John King, against Lake Bacher. Unfortunately, Daniel Duarte gave up his first runs of the year, so it turned a close game into a game that slipped away. Griffin Conine hit a home run. Liam Hicks had an RBI single, but the offense gave you no shot. And it was all the way around. Just a nothing. The only offense they got was a second inning 2-run home run by Tyrone Taylor. And I'd say it ruined the vibes of the 86 reunion. And I was not at the game. I visited my family over the weekend. The vibes of the 86 weekend sounded like it sucked. It looked like there was nobody in the building. And I think the Mets are running into two issues when it comes to the 86 Mets and honoring them on this 40th anniversary. Number one, people go to the ballpark to watch the team. And the team is not good. And the team is boring. And the team is lifeless. And so while, yes, you could talk yourself in to being excited about A.J. Ewing and Carson Bench and some of the young starters, this is still a bad team. So if you are going to pay top dollar, and yes, the Mets in their piggish ways of dynamic pricing had Mets Marlins as a top dollar ticket because of the 86 reunion, you can have a tough time convincing people to come to the ballpark. You can have all the promotions you want, and some of them are good, and some of them will draw people. But the team needs to draw people. So number one, in early August, with the team completely buried and selling players off, it's tough to convince people to come to the ballpark. The second thing is very depressing, but I'm sorry, I have to be honest. In 2009, the New York Mets honored the 1969 Mets. It was the 40th anniversary, much like this, of the 69 champions. And I was at the ballpark that day. Joe and I did a show that day. And I remember saying about the atmosphere that the atmosphere was very dead. And people asked, well, why do you think that was the case? Like, what? Why? Like, the 09 season was a disappointment. And at that point in the season, I don't think they were buried, but it certainly was a disappointing season. I'm sure that's a part of it. But the big part of it that's uncomfortable to say is that when something was 40 years ago, 4-0, you basically need to be 50 to remember it, or 48, 49, 50 to remember it. You have eliminated half your fan base from caring. And the problem I have with the 86 Mets has nothing to do with them. They are a glorious team, and I grew up watching highlight videos of the 86 Mets. But notice, highlight videos, I didn't experience it. So they're a story to me. They're the same story I've learned about American history. I didn't experience it. It's a story. It's a great story. I love the story. I can't get enough of Keith and Ron on the broadcast telling stories. I love the 86 Mets as much as someone can love something that they didn't experience. And if you're older than me and this offends you, ask yourself how much you love something in history that you don't remember, right? And it depends on your age to come up with something. Maybe it's 1969. But if you do remember 1969, and maybe you remember that your parents would have been New York Giant fans, what does the shot heard around the world mean to you? Or what does the Dodgers beating the Yankees in 55 mean to you if you are older? And the answer is, it's cool. You probably appreciate it like I do, but it's history. And so I'll tell you personally, I had no extra motivation to go to this game. Why? How many times am I going to hear about something that I've heard about? Again, no disrespect to the guys. They deserve every ounce of celebratory actions. When you win a championship in New York, it should be celebrated forever. I'm just telling you as a consumer, enough. And that's not me being mad at them. That's me being mad at the Mets because they haven't given us something to celebrate in 40 years. Unless you want to celebrate winning the pennant and blowing game one of the World Series in 2000, or winning the pennant in 2015 and blowing numerous games of that World Series. I guess we could honor that. So I think the crowd showed you that what I'm saying right now is the majority opinion. You're not mad at the 86 Mets. Nobody is. They're an awesome part of our team's history. But we are sick of reliving history because this franchise can't write its own. So I feel bad for those guys. If they looked into the crowd and said, wow, there's nobody here. This doesn't remind me of 1986. What they have to understand is it's not personal to them at all. It really isn't. And nothing I've said is personal about the 86 Mets. It's just the reality that I am so sick and tired of honoring a team that was before I understood baseball, and we haven't had a damn thing to honor since. Sorry.
I'll tell you one person that didn't care about the fan base or anything, the crowd, Ray Knight. He was very vocal about that.
That was great. I love Ray Knight was very entertaining when he's dropping curse words on the SNY broadcast.
Yes.
But look, the celebration was fine. I'm not ripping it. Like I think the tough thing about reunions is that it really isn't anything. It's just announcing guys on the field, it's seeing them, and that's really what the celebration is. Mookie Wilson made a nice quick speech. But overall, it's just, it's enough, man. Like, we keep honoring the same team or the same two teams. They're going to stop honoring 1969 because most people won't be around anymore. And we're getting there with 86. I hate to say that, but we're moving very slowly to a lot of people, maybe even the majority of Met fans, saying, yeah, it's a cool story, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, I think in 2006, I purposely begged my dad. I was like, listen, we have to buy a season ticket plan because I want to be there for the 20th anniversary of the 86 Mets. Like, that was different. That was, yeah, you know, 20 years removed. It was different. You know, the Mets had the level of success they had in 2000, where they were in the World Series, 99 in the playoffs, and yeah, they were on – they have Beltran, they got Delgado. We didn't see that they were going to go to the playoffs in 2006, but it felt there was a good team. There was a good vibe. It's a whole different thing. And I completely agree. I love the history, but we need new history. And there's nothing that's been created so far that makes me celebrate.
Yeah, no, I agree with you about that. Let me read you an email from Farouk. This is a very good email about the Dodgers and the Scooble stuff. He writes, Evan, watching the Dodgers apparently stack the deck with their combination of an elite rotation, elite bullpen, and elite lineup is going to add to the demands for a salary cap. But if we look at our team, yet again, crap the bed with a $380 million payroll, it's fair to say that money isn't everything. No, you need to spend money and also make smart decisions. So here's my proposal. Instead of a salary cap, the Dodgers should have to have David Stearns run the show for the next 5 years. Give the rest of the league a chance. Thank you for your attention to this matter, Farouk. That made me laugh. Thank you very much. Also, I want to read this email. It's in response to something we talked about on the last edition of the Rico Bronya, where an emailer talked about how as much as this season sucks, it's much more relaxing and in a weird way, more enjoyable because there's no pressure when they lose these games. And I disagreed with part of it. I agreed with part of it. I would still prefer a competitive season. I would still prefer agonizing losses, but being in it. But I do understand that you can put your feet up and not get as aggravated in these losses. Well, that conversation really ticked off Luis, who writes, you read an email on the last episode that really annoyed me. There's nothing easier about watching games because the season has been over since June. I respect the emailer's opinion, but he must not be a New Yorker and have to live amongst the Yankee fans mocking us. We went from the brink of being a championship team, stealing Soto from the Yankees to put us over the top, to not making the playoffs over the next two seasons. From talking about no longer being little bro in the city to the worst team in baseball, the only thing I can say is missing is the anticipation of failure, but the pain and embarrassment remains, the disgust of losing games to teams with a third of our payroll are the same. 45, and this is probably the worst season in my Mets fan history. We've had bad seasons, but none with a payroll and expectation this high. Yeah, I think that the season is disgusting and we will continue to get mocked. I think the point is, and I would look at Sunday's game like we're about to talk about, they lost 2-0 to the Marlins. They were losing 1-0 going into the ninth inning. They had the bases loaded and nobody out in the seventh inning, and they couldn't score. They had so many opportunities and they couldn't score. This is a game that would have aged us, and I would have started the Rico about, as opposed to waiting 48 minutes to talk about, if they weren't coming into the game 18 games under 500. The games just don't hurt as much, even if you still watch it, which I do. I'm watching every game. I am still on this incredible streak. I've scored every game this season. 113 for 113. And now I feel like I've got to finish the job. I mean, doesn't matter how bad this season is. I got to go 162. But the losses don't hurt as much. And speaking of losses, Robert Stock makes his first start of the year because of basically the doubleheader. They can't start Freddie Peralta. They didn't want to start Clay Holmes at the major league level, assuming they're going to trade him by Monday afternoon. So they start Robert Stock. And I got to hand it to this guy. What a story he's been. He's an older guy, at least in baseball terms, in his late 30s, actually pitched for the Mets all the way back in 2021, if you recall. And he goes out against the Marlin offense that scores 4.5 runs a game. They are a better offense than we have put up this season. He retires the first six guys and goes 5 innings and only allows 1 run, a home run on a 3-2 pitch to Joe Mack. That's it. And again, I think of Freddie Peralta. I say, wait, Robert Stock this 36, 37-year-old journeyman who's pitched in the KBO, he's pitched in the Mexican League, he's pitched in independent ball. This son of a bitch goes out there and throws a better performance than most of Freddy Peralta's outings this season. What a way to honor the trading of Freddy Peralta. And he does it with just 70 pitches over five innings. So great performance by Robert Stock. The problem was the Mets, as always, could not figure out Sandy Alcantara. And it's not about not scoring runs. It's about the opportunities. This game, final game of the series, a chance to split the series against Miami and split the homestand. So a 5-5 homestand against LA, against Atlanta, against Miami. Hey, whole grand scheme of things, not horrible. Not going to do anything because they're so buried, but not horrible. Chance to split the series. Get a great outing from a journeyman and think about all the scoring opportunities. 2-1, nobody out in the third with Francisco Alvarez, AJ Ewing, and Francisco Lindor. They all come up small. Runner on second in the fourth, nothing. Runner on second in the fifth, AJ Ewing, foul pop up. But the worst was in the seventh inning when they got Alcantara out of the game down 1-0. 2-1, nobody out. Marcus Semien draws a walk against Michael Peterson. They got bases loaded, nobody out. And here is Jorge Polanco and his 134 batting average to strike out. And really hear it from the crowd. I'll say it again. He was better off never coming back. He was better off Jed Lowrying this season as opposed to coming back and being as awful as he's been. Francisco Alvarez strikes out. A.J. Ewing, who ran into a lot of big opportunities in this game and did not have a great series. A.J. Ewing has been dancing with a net negative award. He was 2-for-17 in this series, including 0-for-5 in the finale, in which he came up with guys on base every inning, other than the first, when he mathematically couldn't. 2-1, 1-out in the third, he grounds out, almost into a double play. Runner on second, 2 outs in the fifth, foul pop-up. Bases loaded, 2 out in the seventh, grounds out, and he ends the game with 2-1 and 2 out. So he was 0-for-4 with runners in scoring position. Dreadful by A.J. Ewing. But he wasn't the only one. They get a leadoff double from Francisco Lindor in the eighth inning. Bo Bichette can't even advance him. Carson Bench grounds out. Luis Robert Jr. flies out. It was just a pitiful, pitiful offensive performance. They ended up going 0-for-12. With runners in scoring position. So they could have won this game. They should have won this game. They wasted a really good performance by Robert Stock. They wasted another good bullpen effort outside of Devin Williams giving up a run in the ninth inning, which at that point, I mean, it didn't matter. One run is like 11 runs with this offense. But Raley was good. Weaver was good. Brazoban was good. Three guys who all may be gone by the time the Mets play their next game in Cleveland on Tuesday. And it's completely wasted by this offense, top to bottom. Top to bottom, bad performance by the offense. And it was lifeless. It was almost as if, and I don't know if this is true, maybe it is, the guys just, it's like the moment where you say, we're trading all these guys away. Let's just get the hell out of here. Now, the problem is you've got 2 full months to still play baseball. It's not as if the season ends next week. So all of these guys that gave you these lifeless at-bats, especially with guys on base, you could be down in the dumps. I mean, you got 2 months left. They've played 113 games. Do the math. There's still plenty of games left in the season. It was just overall an awful performance and a disappointing end to a homestand and a disappointing end to a series against the Miami Marlins. With that said, there needs to be a Rico, I'm the man right now, star of the series. There has to be somebody. Now, who are your candidates, you ask? Well, if you go back to the game they won, Nolan McClain pitched pretty well, despite giving up a lead and showing too much emotion after he got the first out of the seventh inning. But he went out and threw 6 1/3 innings and only allowed 2 runs. I think clearly when you look at the starting pitchers, he was one of the best. Robert Stock, give him a lot of credit for the finale performance, the 5 innings, 1 run. Brooks Raley is also a really good candidate because in game one, the one game that the Mets won, Raley comes in and cleans up McClain's mess by getting a double play and then getting through the eighth inning. So Raley got 5 outs and the victory in the one game they won. And then he comes in the sixth inning against the top of the order of the Marlins and keeps that game 1-0. So two performances by Raleigh. I think he deserves honorable mention. As far as the offense, it's really Francisco Lindor. He went 6-for-12 in this series, hit a home run, drove in a couple of runs. My hesitation on Lindor, and this would be a breakthrough for him because he has not won yet the Rico I'm the Man Right Now star of the series, was the importance of the error in the Zach Thornton start. Like, that was a significant error that unfortunately put Thornton behind the eight ball. And I thought damaged his chances of pitching well. So I don't know about you, Hoff. I hesitate to give it to Francisco Lindor. I lean towards Brooks Raley. And maybe that's a farewell to Brooks. Like, thanks, you get to go out with a Rico I'm the Man Right Now. But I think it's him. I mean, he impacted two games. He did his job incredibly well. It can't be easy doing your job when you've got the trade stuff hovering over you. So I think it's close. And look, Lindor, again, 6-for-12, hits in every game of this series. I think he's a fair candidate. I thought Carson Bench was on his way till he took an 0-for-3. But my vote would be Brooks Raley as the man right now. What say you, Huff?
I kind of lean towards Lindor. I mean, he did have an impact on every game. I know you're right. He had a bad impact on one. But, I mean, he hit every game, and he's the only guy you could say that did that. And for all the negative that we've talked about Lindor this season, you're right. It rarely has a significant impact on the win, but Lindor was the offense for this team in a four-game series.
Here's how we will break the tie. One of our regular emailers, Howard, always supplies all the stats for the series, and then he gives his opinion. So let's see if he has a Rico I'm the Man Right Now. That's one of our two guys, and I think that would break the tie. So I will pull up his email right now, and he's with me. Brooks Raley is the man right now, according to Howard. He pitched two games, 2 2/3 innings with one hit, no walks allowed. Got the winning game one. This is not a sentimental pick based on the likely trade. He earned this award positively affecting two games. Carson Bench was very good, 5-for-15. He made two very nice catches in game four, but did not affect the winning as much as Raley. Lindor was good, 6-for-15, but the poor defense in game three knocked him down a notch. I am word for word in agreement with Howard. I think if Lindor doesn't make that error in game three, and who knows how that start unfolds, obviously the Mets probably lose anyway because they only scored two runs on a Tyrone Taylor two-run home run, but I think that error knocks him down. So unfortunately, Francisco, you'll have to wait another series. Brooks Raley, in maybe your final moments as a New York Met, you are the man right now.
And as congratulations.
I look through the season, this is his first. So we got another first-timer.
All right.
You know the moment Brooks Raley was the man right now?
No.
That kind of sucks.
I feel like he was. Was he hurt for a second? No. Well, here's the big thing is the big moments for the pitchers were so few and far between. And if they were successful, they'd still lose. And it wasn't because of him. So he never really had the chance to impact. By the way, we should give a little bit of a cred to Xavier and Curry because he came out and pitched five innings, saved the bullpen. Got to take a tap on that.
No, you're 1,000% right. And he wouldn't have been the first to win the Rico I'm the Man Right Now and his reward being sent down. That's happened a few times, but that's a good call. Xavier Curry bailed out Kodai Senga. I don't want to say bailed out Kodai Senga because Kodai was okay for the first four innings, but he bailed out the bullpen in a game that could have used four or five different relievers. So I agree with you. Honorable mention to Xavier Curry. The net negative is very easy to make. There is one guy that stands above the rest. Doesn't mean there aren't other honorable mentions. Doesn't mean there aren't other guys we should talk about. But how is it not the abomination known as Jorge Polanco? He is horrific. And I think that at bat in the seventh inning of a 1-0 game, when he comes up with the bases loaded and one out, a chance to have his quote-unquote Met moment. I'm being sarcastic. And he freaking strikes out. He ends up going 0-for-10 in this series. 0-for-10. And that's without getting the start in game three. He gave us a break by not starting game three, but he was 0-for-3 in the finale. I talked about him coming up with bases loaded, nobody out, striking out. He also came up in the ninth inning with a runner on first and one out, and he struck out looking. He did not play in game three. In game two of this series, he went 0 for 4. He did reach on an error, and he struck out twice. And in the opener of this series, went 0 for 3. So he takes an over. He has, in my opinion, the biggest at-bat of game four with bases loaded, nobody out. And he takes an over. The only other guy, and this would make you happy, is Brett Beatty also took an over. He went 0 for 8 in this series.
It doesn't make me happy.
I think it's Polanco. Luis Robert Jr. is another candidate, but he also got the game-winning hit in the one game they won. So yeah, despite Robert Jr. doing very little else and going 2 for 12, I think it's got to be Jorge Polanco, right? I
mean, Ewing didn't have a great series either. That's the other person. He kind of felt like a little flat this series. I'll totally go with Polanco. I just remember when he came back in the first game and he hit that long fly foul ball that Steve Cohen said, Gary Cohen said, this is what the Mets offense was missing. And it happened to be a foul ball. Yes, that's what we were missing. Somebody who could hit long fly balls foul and just be a regular out. He is terrible. He's still batting, 91 since he returned? It's a joke.
Yeah, I. By the way, I do agree with you. A.J. Ewing was very close to winning this thing, and I think a lot of it were the big at-bats he had in game four. But overall, he didn't have a good series. He went 2 for 17. So I think A.J. Ewing is an honorable mention. Bo Bichette is an honorable mention. I guess you could look at the pitching and say Kodai Senga, though I feel bad doing that because I thought he was so good for four innings, and then he just ran into it in the fifth.
Hey, he was good enough that the Padres looked in on him, okay? And they're interested in trading for him. So, hey, listen, that's a plus in my book.
Yeah, Kodai Senga and Luis Robert Jr. specifically are the two guys where it does not matter what the return is. Like, I think those are two guys where you move away from them. Because in Senga's case, it's just getting rid of him for next year, assuming the Padres or anyone else wouldn't make the Mets pay for the whole thing. Like, that would be a big turnoff having to do that. And with Luis Robert Jr., he's just not going to be on the team. So whatever you can get back, even if it's one marginal prospect, would probably be worth it. So congratulations, Jorge Polanco. You are the net negative. And for Jorge, it's the second time he's won it in three series. So this was the Jorge Polanco series in terms of being the net negative. And they're going to run him out there. I mean, he's going to play. And why wouldn't you play him at this point? You're almost just trying to get him going, thinking that does that help him next year when, unfortunately, he will be on this team.
We could also say goodbye to MJ Melendez. I don't know if you mentioned that already, too.
Yeah, he was DFA'd, roster kind of clerical work. But yes, MJ Melendez, who did have some moments here. He has won a Rico on the Man right now. So he exists in some positive nature. The 2026 Mets, unfortunately, did get DFA'd. So overall, very mediocre homestand. Most of the attention is on this trade deadline. Now, here's what we'll do. Okay, Monday's deadline is at 6 o'clock. So we will do a Rico Bronya as soon as the trade deadline ends. So you want to say, for those who want to consume it live, a 6:15 Rico Hoff, that probably makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be on once the deadline passes. I thought about doing one during the deadline. Here's why I don't think it's a good idea. It's me checking my phone for 45 minutes. At least when the deadline is over, we have closure to it. These are the moves. Let's analyze. Let's break down what they did, what they didn't do, other moves that were made, and at least we know. I think the problem in doing one during the deadline is a lot of crap is happening. So we'll do a live Rico Bronya. For those that consume it on YouTube at 6:15, for those that download the Rico, it'll be available for you soon after that, and we'll react to the Mets trade deadline, and then the season gets dark. We'll still be here. We'll still be doing Ricos, but man, it's going to get dark post-trade deadline.
We'll be doing a lot of drunk Ricos.
Yeah, we may have to add a few of those to the schedule.
Let me ask you a question, though. So the Mets have made, am I correct in my calculations, they've made two moves so far. AJ yes. Minter, Freddie Peralta. Yeah. How many more do you think they're going to make? Because I've heard between 6 and 10. What do you think the number is on the Mets?
I don't know if David Stearns agrees with the sentiment I laid out earlier that there needs to be a pretty high bar to trade Luke Weaver and Oscar Brazman. I can't just take back anything because they are under contract next year. I think Raley is gone. I would think Robert Jr. is gone. And I'd say one of those relievers, and Clay Holmes has got, I guess the number will be about six, would probably be my guess. But we'll see. We'll see what it turns into. Anyhow, we appreciate you downloading the Rico Bronya. Of course, you can always email us. We try to mix in as many emails as we can. We appreciate that. TheRicoB@gmail.com. And like I said, we'll have a Rico Bronya reaction to the trade deadline live on the WFAN YouTube page at about 6:15 and wherever you download your podcast. Thanks for listening to Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.